it dry, don't let it ride.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. The topic today is the U.S. economy's triple witching hour. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, three major events of the last week. How will they play out? Of course, they are related. What's the bottom line? Well, what are these events? Well, right now, today, Trump has signed the bill for a budget of $1.3 trillion increase in the budget, mostly defense spending increase. We'll talk about that. It comes on top of a net $3 trillion tax cut for the rich and their corporations and investors. He's going hand over fist here, giving money to his defense sector buddies and his banking buddies and all his corporate buddies. Yes, and it's already the opening shot is beginning to appear to attack Social Security and Medicare more aggressively and food stamps and education and all the rest to pay for it. We are now looking at, even by conservative estimates, deficits for the next decade of more than $1 trillion a year. So we're going to add $10 trillion to the already $20 trillion U.S. national federal debt. Oh, well, gee, aren't these Republicans supposed to be fiscal conservatives? Not when they can give themselves money, they're not. Only when they take it out on grandma and grandpa and people who are on Medicare and all the rest. Then they're fiscal conservatives. The other major event is the new Federal Reserve Chairman Powell announces another rate hike in the federal funds rate, short-term interest rate of 0.25%, now at 1.75, and rising fast, and predicting three more rate hikes this year and three more next year. Well, what is that going to mean? Well, as I've been saying, and if you check my Twitter handle and my blog, this is another credit crunch coming and precipitating another recession by 2019 if they stay on that rate hike trajectory. Okay, so the federal funds rate going up, monetary policy tightening, big tax cuts for the 1% and their corporations, big spending increases for the defense companies. And what's the third one here? Oh, trade war. Trade war. Well, we talked about that last week, didn't we? And we said, if you go back and listen to the show last week, this is not a trade war. This is a trade war with China. China's always been the target here. And it's really skirmishes. Opening rounds of skirmishes and maneuvering like boxers in the first round in a ring. They're circling each other, throwing jabs. You see, this isn't a knockout punch trade war. This is maneuvers going on. Well, we'll get to that too. Three important events. How are they related? How will they play out? The topic of today's show. Okay, let's turn to the budget bill signed today. $1.3 trillion for the next 6 months, you see. It's only for the last half of the current fiscal year. More is coming. At the heart of this bill of $1.3 trillion, the biggest ever, is an $80 billion increase in defense spending, war spending, $80 billion increase. Well, that's pretty significant, isn't it? $80 billion. Well, that's an increase on top of the Pentagon's already $600 billion plus budget. So they're boosting the Pentagon budget here close to $700 billion. But you know, that's not the true war spending of this
Hello,
country.
please leave a message.
That's not the true war spending. No, the true war spending is the Pentagon plus about $300 billion a year now. Well, where does the other $300 billion come from? Well, Homeland Security, atomic energy, in which we have this trillion-dollar idea of proposing new nuclear arms, the Energy Department, which pays for all the fuel for the military, the Veterans Administration, and CIA, NSA, which have become military arms. Don't fool yourself, they got their own military apparatus now. State Department plays in that military surveillance game. Corporate subsidies for Lockheed and others. And what we call the black budget that does not show up in any of the public estimations of what the budget is and the deficit is. What's the black budget? Well, this is an off-budget spending that only a few people in Congress know about, the heads of the Armed Services Committees, maybe, in which we spend at least $50 more billion a year on secret military development projects. Yes, we don't even know what this stuff is. At least 50 billion. It was 50 billion a decade ago. It's probably higher now. Well, you add it all up, $700 billion for the Pentagon and $300 billion more, $1 trillion for defense, $1 trillion a year. And by the way, that's going up once again in October by another $80 billion for the military. $165 billion proposed for 2 years a couple months ago, right? And this is only signing the bill today for part of that. The other shoe's going to drop later in the year. Well, wait a minute. I mean, is this all defense spending? No, there's $63 billion in so-called domestic programs that the Democrats say that they signed and agreed to this bill because of the $63 billion in domestic programs. Well, most of those domestic programs are continuations, you see. Continuations like SHIP, SHIP, and other programs for health for the kids, which are fine. No one's against that, but it's no net increase. It's no net increase, very little net increase in this bill for social programs. Big increase net for defense programs. Okay. Also significant in this bill, nothing for DACA. This is the 800,000, actually more than that. You count their families and everything, over 1 million people who came to the US, mostly from Latin America, I would add, as children brought by their parents. Not their fault, they're illegal. Well, they're not illegal. They have as much right to be here as anybody. They've been living here all their lives, they don't know anything else. Okay, this is called the Dreamers Act, you see. And Trump has been dangling this out there in front of the Democrats, using it to suck them into more and more agreement for things he wants, and he keeps holding it away, right? He keeps dangling it, the plum, and he doesn't give it to him. And he says, "Well, give me something." And they give him something, and he says, "Well, no, I'm not giving it to you yet. You got to give me more." And he just keeps playing this game. Well, what did he get? Well, he got a down payment on his $30 billion wall, $1.6 billion. What did the Democrats get? Did they get any down payment on DACA? No. So he's got his foot in the door on his wall, and the Democrats got nothing in exchange for it. Well, you watch when the next bill comes up for the budget in October, he'll get another multi-billion dollar for another segment of his wall. Okay? And that's going to continue. That's going to continue that game. When the Democrats earlier in the year, they said that, this is a line in the sand. We'll never agree to any budget here. with Donald unless, you know, he agrees to DACA. And of course, then they caved in, didn't they? They caved in. And then Dick Durbin, the Democrat leader, comes out and says, well, next time we're going to hold firm. Well, we just had next time. Did they hold firm? No, they got nothing, you know, and they're going to get nothing. The DACA kids are on the hook, and they're going to stay on the hook at least another year. They'll wait and play this game. Both wings of the corporate party of America, Democrats, Republicans, will play this game, dangling these people out there for at least another year, because it doesn't really come to a head that they're going to have to be deported for another year. All right, so he's got part of his wall. This is going to produce, as I said, multi-trillion-dollar budgets for multi-years, at least the next decade. In fact, J.P. Morgan Chase Bank estimated the first year of this is going to be a $1.2 trillion deficit, $1.2 trillion annual deficit, and that we're going to have annual deficits of $1 trillion every year for the next 10 years. And if we have a recession, which is extremely likely within the next 2 or 3 years, if we have a recession, then it's going to be 2 or 3 years or more of $1.5 trillion deficits. One and a half. We could have $12, $13 trillion added to the debt. And what's the cause? Two things, simply. Tax cuts for the rich, $3 trillion. I've talked about that. Not $1.5 trillion, $3 trillion. $5 trillion for corporations and investors. $2 trillion in hikes for the middle class leaves $3 trillion. And now we've got $300 billion, looks like, additional budget spending deficits, mostly for walls and defense companies and so forth. Well, it's not all defense companies, you know. This is the biggest hike in military pay in decades in this $80 billion, the biggest hike in decades. And, you know, I bet if we dissected who's in the military going to get the big pay increase, it's going to be the officers and generals and not so much for the rank and file. Yeah, well, they're rewarding, you know, their officers because they think, well, you know, we may have to rely on these guys even more if we're going to have a war in North Korea. So we're going to have to deal with that. Let's make sure they're well taken care of and they're happy. So this is what this is really about going on. Okay. So we're going to have multi-trillion dollar deficits and more on the debt. And this is creating what they really want in terms of what Paul Ryan wants, in terms of going after Medicare, going after Social Security. Let's cut, cut, cut. Going after food stamps, going after education, privatize it, you know, and go after transport, you know, infrastructure bill. Infrastructure spending never happened, won't happen. What will happen is a phony infrastructure bill that's really more subsidies for commercial real estate. That's what this will be, already taken form. The government's not going to spend a lot of money on building bridges and all the rest that needs to be done. No, no. They'll hand out more money under the guise of infrastructure to commercial real estate interests who are Trump's buddies, because that's what he is, a commercial real estate speculator. Let's talk about Trump a little bit before we move on to the next topic here of the Fed and the Fed rate increase. Okay. What is Trump doing? He's firing all these traditional elites, insiders that he had to take on when he first came into office. You know, he one by one, he's getting rid of them all, right? Tillerson's gone, right? Other departments and agencies, they're leaving. We got the biggest exodus in its history from the State Department going. He's going after the bureaucracy in which the traditional elites, the more liberal elites, have been entrenched, and he's cleaning it out. He's putting his people in those departments to clean them out so he doesn't get this opposition from the bureaucracy that he's been getting. We got this guy Pompeo from the CIA is now running the State Department. Well, the CIA just took over the State Department, folks, if you haven't watched. And now we've got this torture advocate running the CIA. And now he gets rid of McMasters and he brings in this guy Bolton. Well, who is Bolton? Well, he's one of the 1990 neocons who advocated for years that we have to have wars in the Middle East to clean it out. You know, we have to go after Iraq. We have to go after Libya. We have to go after Syria. And, of course, then Iran. And then the outlier, of course, is North Korea. This is what the neocons were proposing when they came in office with Bush. Okay, they had their hands full with Afghanistan and Iraq, and since then they've moved on to Yemen and Syria, and of course they got rid of Gaddafi in Libya, right? Perpetual wars in the Middle East by the U.S. with its proxy, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia just bought $110 billion in U.S. arms from us. Oh, well, you think that they might provoke something with Iran? I think so. I think they're the proxy of choice in the Middle East for the U.S. Watch out, because now with Pompeo and Bolton in, Iran's the new target. You see, they'll provoke something with Iran, and it'll probably under the guise of some complaint of Saudi Arabia. And of course, we're using Saudi Arabia to go after a potential Iran ally there in Yemen, or Yemen, right? So, you know, the U.S. is lighting fires all over the Middle East, sitting back behind the scenes, playing games. Of course, they got checked in Syria, maybe even checkmated, we'll see. But don't count out Israel from stirring that pot again. This guy Bolton is very, very dangerous. He's a nutcase. He really is. And he's impetuous. He's got a huge anger coefficient here and notorious for his anger and a big ideologue, right-wing ideologue. And by the way, if you're not scared of Bolton as the new National Security Advisor replacing McMasters, you should be, because he's the guy who's just advocated a month ago in public, in writing, that we should engage in a first strike against North Korea. Yeah, that's what we should do. Well, the South Koreans are terrified that the U.S. is stoking war in the Korean Peninsula. And one of the reasons why perhaps they just agreed to big concessions to the U.S. on trade. You see, the U.S. has a free trade treaty with South Korea, and the U.S., Trump, is out to renegotiate all these trade treaties, you see? And the way he does it is put pressure on them. He comes out with outrageous statements that look like, you know, he's gone crazy on issues, but that's just his mode of operation. Comes out and says outrageous things, gets the media and everybody all hyped up, and then he backpedals and he settles for negotiation. Well, that's what he did with NAFTA and Mexico, and now, of course, he's backpedaling on Mexico. They'll come up with changes in NAFTA that benefit U.S. corporations, not U.S. workers. They'll come up with changes there. And, you know, he last 2 weeks ago, he comes out with this comprehensive tariff on aluminum and steel everywhere. He gets the Europeans all in a frenzy, and everyone else in the world in Asia is having paroxysms of anxiety because of his statement. And then what does he do in the past week? He backpedals. Oh, we're going to exempt Mexico and Canada. Oh, we're going to exempt Europe. And now we're going to exempt Brazil and Argentina. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's Mexico, Brazil, and Japan who are the big importers of steel to the United States. It's not China. It's not China. In fact, we export aluminum and steel to China, believe it or not. So he's exempting those who are really responsible for the imports to the U.S., Brazil, Mexico, and others. And he uses this thing in North Korea now, obviously, to get the South Koreans to sign big changes to the benefit of U.S. corporations. Well, that's what's going on here with China. You see, this so-called trade war is to instigate a big issue and get the media all hyped up. And the U.S. stock markets this week contract 724 points. The Dow drops over the trade war. I'm not so sure if it's a trade war or the Fed rate hikes that we're going to talk about. But he gets everybody going and upset, right? And gets them to the table, and then he tweaks it. You see, he tweaks it. There's not going to be a trade war with China. There's going to be renegotiations with China. By the way, you know, the announcement of the trade sanctions, well, not sanctions, but tariffs on China, affect $50 billion of Chinese exports to the U.S. And what it amounts to is a 12% increase in tariffs on that $50 billion. Well, that's not significant. You know, how much does China import in goods to the United States? Well, I'll tell you how much. We have a net deficit, trade deficit of China, $475 billion. $475 billion. However, as part of that net deficit, the U.S. exports $244 billion in services to China. So the goods deficit of China for the U.S. is about $700 billion in goods. In other words, they export to the U.S. We import from them $700 billion in goods. We export to them $244 billion in services, so the net is $475 billion trade deficit. Well, 50 billion, 12% tariffs on 50 billion, as part of 700 billion, you know, forgive me, but that is not a warlike move. And what have the Chinese done? Well, they've responded even more weakly to the U.S. You know, they talk tough in the press, just as Trump talks tough, but that's not how they act, you see. And what have they done? Well, they've imposed some tariffs on U.S., mostly agricultural goods, you know, because it's mostly what we export to the rest of the world. Yes, our defense exports are huge, but our agricultural exports are really huge. They're going to put some tariffs on our exports, our agriculture exports to them, and a few other items. Okay, this is not a war. This is an opening skirmish. This is a skirmish, and could it result in a war? Trade war? Well, it might. But one thing is clear: China's the only target here. This is not a global trade war. You know, it's as I said last week, worth repeating here, this is much like what Reagan did in 1985 when he targeted Japan, forced Japan to come to the bargaining table, and forced Japan to revalue their currency so that their exports to the U.S. would decline. You know, instead of the U.S. Taking action to lower its inflation rate and its currency, the dollar, what they did was force Japan to pay for what the U.S. had done by raising their inflation rate and the value of their currency, the yen, to slow their exports to the U.S. Well, that's what Reagan did in 1985, and it worked. It worked. You know, in the long run, of course, it sent Japan into a financial downturn and crisis and implosion, financial implosion in their economy in 1990-91. But that's a consequence of them agreeing to this agreement, which was negotiated in a hotel in New York called the Plaza. That's why it's called the Plaza Accord. And then Reagan did the same thing to a lesser extent with the Germans in Europe in following that, called the Louvre Accord. The Louvre Museum is where it was negotiated, you see. And of course, what that did was set Europe on a track to say, oh, we need our own common market here to protect us from the US. And they engaged in that common market and developed their own common market called the European Union, the customs union following that. So these are maneuvers, you know, and Trump is doing what Reagan did. Well, not only did Reagan do it, but Nixon did it in 1971, 73. This was called, ended up in the Smithsonian Agreement, where he devalued the dollar and made the U.S. more competitive, U.S. companies more competitive, both in the U.S. and abroad with the Europeans. So Nixon attacked the Europeans at the cost of destroying the post-war international monetary system called Bretton Woods. So he attacked the Europeans, and Reagan attacked the Japanese, and now we got Trump attacking the Chinese, you see. And it's all part of American capitalism maneuvering periodically with its capitalist allies, who are our competitors economically, and maneuvering with them to get a better deal globally, better share the global trade pie for U.S. corporations, right? And why are they doing this now? Because there's all kind of signs that the global economy is slowing down. And it has been for several years, since 2015 now, slower rate of growth in global trade and the economy. Of course, the past year, we had a little blip back up, but now there are signs, once again, that the global economy is starting to slow once again. So they know long run that it's slowing down, and they're all maneuvering here in order to, they meaning all the major economies of the world, maneuvering to protect their interests and to ensure for themselves a bigger piece of a shrinking pie, or a pie that's not growing as fast, you see, and soon will shrink. So, you know, that's the significance of this trade deal. And the U.S. is looking to boost its economy through export trade, just as the Germans do and the Japanese do. Well, why is the U.S. now focusing more on export-driven GDP? Well, because they know the real economy is not doing so good. We've been talking about that, right? And you look at retail sales and consumer spending, they are weakening very fast, particularly in auto sales and particularly in housing and other big ticket items where people got to borrow money, you see. The U.S. consumer household is almost borrowed out. Our total household debt today is greater than it was in 2007. Greater, higher. We keep borrowing because our wage incomes aren't growing, you see. That's the only way people maintain their standard of living. And, of course, corporate America loves that because whatever you borrow, you got to pay an interest on. That means you get part of your wages in the future, guaranteed. That's what interest payments are, guaranteed claim on your future income. So they like it. They don't have to pay us wage increases. They like that. And then they get back some of the wages we've already earned through interest charges. So the system is running on debt, because debt is far more profitable for them than given wage increases. But the consumer is almost tapped out, you see. And by the end of the year, this will be very clear, especially as rates rise. And, of course, that brings us to our third topic, which is the Federal Reserve and its move here in the past week. Here we have the new Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, taking over, and his first Fed meeting here to raise rates occurred on Wednesday or Thursday. And he did raise rates as expected. What's interesting is the projection that there will be at least three rate increases, maybe four this year, maybe four, and then three the next year, and two the year after that. Well, if they're quarter rate, you know, 0.25% each of them, we're at 1.75 in the short-term federal funds rate, which is the benchmark rate that influences all other interest rates in the U.S. economy, almost. So 1.7 And if we get three more this year, we're at 2.5%. And if we get three next year, we're at 3.25% in the short-term federal funds rate. And that means all the other rates are going to rise proportionally to the federal funds rate. And if you're paying now 4.5% for an auto loan, you're going to pay 6.5% for that auto loan within 18 months from now. 6.5%. You think people are going to buy automobiles at 6.5%? No, the auto industry is already in a downturn going on because rates where they are now at 4% is going to kill the auto industry pretty much at a time when auto debt is already over $1 trillion in auto debt, $1 trillion. Households, American households, right? Student debt, 1.3 trillion. Credit card debt, 1.1 trillion. Mortgage debt, 8 trillion, $14 trillion in household debt today, more than it was in 2007. Okay. If you look at total debt in the US, we've added $20 trillion in total debt since 2008 in less than 10 years. 20 trillion more. It's now $70 trillion, which means all sectors, the government, households, and businesses are what they call over-leveraged. In other words, massive amounts of debt. And should we have any kind of a downturn, a recession, that debt cannot be paid. The principal and interest won't be paid. And when you can't pay principal and interest, you default. And when you default, the value of those financial instruments and debt collapses. And that's what's going to happen on the business side, you see, because over half of that 20 trillion net increase is corporate debt. And it's poor quality corporate debt. It's junk bond debt, trillions of dollars of junk bond debt. And then the debt just one level above that in terms of rating, triple B, even more, in other words, almost junk, damn close to junk. That's even greater than the junk debt. So you got all this tremendous debt that's been taken on by corporations who've given themselves a second lease on life, even though they should have gone under for various reasons. They've kept themselves going by borrowing, borrowing, borrowing. And now when they have to roll over that debt and borrow again at a higher rate, they won't be able to do it. The banks won't give it to them. And then we're going to see a sharp increase in corporate defaults along with household defaults. Of course, the federal government won't default, right? Because they just keep raising their debt level. US Treasuries will not default. But what might happen is that the foreigners' purchase of US Treasury debt might dramatically slow down. And then the US Treasury, right, is going to have to raise rates through the Fed even more to be able to borrow even more money to pay for the huge deficit. We may see interest on the debt annually after 10 years, maybe even before that, reaching $1 trillion a year. Just the interest on the debt by 2027 might very well be $1 trillion a year. Now, with that $10 trillion increase in the debt, the government debt I talked about previously, and $1 trillion increase in the interest payments on that debt, I'm talking about government debt now. I move from private corporate debt to government debt. With that, huge, huge deficits, huge. Do you think Paul Ryan is not going to use that as an excuse to go after entitlements? You betcha. That offensive's already been launched, you see. And if you go to the media and the business press today, what are they doing? They're bringing on all these guys who are saying, oh, yes, the new budget bill here, defense budget bill, is a budget buster, debt buster here going on. They don't talk about how the tax cuts are even a greater budget deficit a buster. No, they just talk about, well, okay, today, yeah, we're adding more to the budget and the debt, and therefore we have to go after entitlements. I was watching TV and the business Bloomberg here today, and they bring on this guy, former Senator Gregg from New Hampshire, and Gregg is talking this message line, this spin. Oh, it's entitlements, entitlements, entitlements. That's all he's talking about. And then one of the other participants on the interview, a journalist, says, "Well, what about the tax cuts and budget deficit effects from that?" He stumbles, Gregg stumbles, and then he says, "Oh, the tax cuts have nothing to do with it. No, it's all entitlements, entitlements. You see, they're being sent out. Watch the editorial page of the business press. Entitlements, entitlements, entitlements. They're going after Social Security, folks. Hear that, all you grandmas out there? Social Security, they're going after it, right? They're going after food stamps, all you single moms with kids. Getting paid minimum wage at Walmart and other places. Yeah, they're going after your food stamps, right? You can starve. Education, right? What are they going to do about education? Nothing. Privatize it. If you got a problem, go private. And that's what DeVos, the education secretary, is saying. That's the solution. Privatize education. Why do they hate education? Because they make no money off of it. There's no profit from education. It's just a public good. And they want to privatize and profitize everything, everything. This is their objective here for the next decade. So the 1% can get even richer than they are. All right, let's go back to Powell and the Fed rate hike. All right, 1.75. And other interest rates are rising in tandem here. Right? We've got the 10-year Treasury bill, another key indicator, at 2.9, pushing 3.0 interest on a 10-year Treasury. And we have another important indicator, interest rate indicator, the LIBOR, London Interbank Rate, right? Which for the 3 month is at 2%, 3 month LIBOR, 2%, right? Federal funds rate, 1.75, 10-year treasury, 2.93. Now, what I've been saying, and I hold to this, is that they cannot raise rates much more. Back in 2008, the Federal Reserve, Bernanke's Federal Reserve, raised rates to 5.25% right before the crash. Now, those rates did not cause the crash, but they precipitated the crash. In other words, the four more fundamental causes were already building in a credit system based on derivatives and contagion, right? And the subprime mortgages, and so forth. That was already baked into the system and ready to go bust. But it was the hiking of the interest rates that then choked off liquidity. In other words, businesses and others couldn't borrow because it was too expensive to borrow, or they wouldn't borrow. And then, when you can't borrow and roll over your debt, you don't pay the principal or the interest or both. And then, this whole process of crash occurs. And when the crash occurs, then there's no liquidity. No one can borrow. No one wants the loan. No one can borrow. And then it feeds on itself. It gets worse. Well, that's what happened when the Fed raised rates to 5.25. Back in 2008. Now, will the Fed be able to raise it to 5.25 before precipitating once again another liquidity crisis, as they call? No. It will happen well before, well before. Well, we're at 1.75 Fed funds rate. What will precipitate a liquidity crisis once again if the Fed fund rate rises to what level? Well, I'm predicting a 2.5% Fed funds rate puts you right on the cusp of precipitating another crisis. I'm predicting the LIBOR rate at 2%, 3 month LIBOR, 3% goes from 2% to 3%, same thing could happen. And I'm predicting the 10-year Treasury rate, 2.9 now, somewhere around 3.5, 3.75 the same thing happens. Now, all those rates, you know, the federal funds rate was 5.25 back in 2008. And if we raise it three more times this year, which is what's being projected, you know, we got 2.5% on the Fed funds rate. I'm saying you're right on the cusp there. So by the end of the year, if the Fed follows through with three more rate hikes, we could very well, in the beginning of 2019, experience the beginning of another credit crisis and definitely another recession. Whether it becomes a financial crisis-driven recession as 2008-9 was remains to be seen. But certainly a normal recession, normal, quote-quote, right, where you don't have a financial crash associated. You just have a big contraction because the rates are too high. But, you know, the possibility of a financial-driven crisis again is increasingly high. As I write in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, published in 2016, right? The financial system is growing more fragile. Fragile means it's potentially unstable, and you may have a major financial instability event. If you look at various indicators, that fragility is growing within the system, in various ways. I would point people to my website. You can get to through my blog, jackrasmus.com. On the website, I'm running a series of articles, excerpts from my conclusion to that 2000 Systemic Fragility book, my theory of systemic fragility. It's a five-part series. It really takes that whole chapter and puts it online for people to read. How I believe and why the global system, financial system, is becoming more fragile and prone to financial instability once again, right? You can see it with the junk bonds. And by the way, the junk bond problem is probably going to be focused on the retail sector, which is in deep trouble in the U.S., and maybe energy, but I would say the retail sector more so. Junk bonds, companies that have been kept alive, zombie companies, by being able to borrow more and more. That's why we have $10 trillion increase since 2008 in private corporate debt, private and corporate debt, $10 trillion. Government, $10 trillion, right? Through all the tax cuts and defense hikes and wars. Thank you, Mr. Obama and Mr. Bush, and now Mr. Trump, giving him another $3 trillion. That's the reason why the government deficit has developed from 10 to 20 trillion since 2008. But the private side, the corporate debt and the household debt, has also increased $10 trillion. And that means the whole system is highly leveraged, full of debt. And when it can't pay the principal and interest on those debt, which happens in recessions, then you have defaults. Then you have collapsing financial asset prices, and that just accelerates the whole process downward, which is what happened in 2008. Okay, so watch out. Well, what is it? Why is this so? Why is it that it doesn't take as much? Why is it doesn't take as much to precipitate a liquidity crisis and a contraction today that it did in 2007-8? Mm-hmm. It's because the relationship between interest rate changes and real investment being investing in buildings and structures and plant and equipment and transport equipment and inventories, that's real investment, as contrasted to financial investment, which is investment in stocks and bonds and derivatives and exchange and so forth, right? Two different animals here, right? That's because the relationship between interest rate changes and real investment has deteriorated, right? We saw since 2008, interest rates were down to almost zero, and it really didn't stimulate real investment in the U.S., okay? And now, of course, we're raising interest rates. So that's certainly not going to stimulate real investment. So that's a big example of how the relationship, the causal relationship between interest rates and investment, is deteriorating, right? There's the flip side of this deterioration, and that is it doesn't take much to raise interest rates to have an effect on declining real investment. In other words, compressing, depressing real investment. Once again, reducing interest rates does not produce a real investment increase very much, but conversely, raising interest rates will depress real investment quickly and significantly. That's where we're at. And the reason for that is the debt overhang. That's the problem, you see. And that's deeply embedded in the whole system now, that debt overhang. And that's why we didn't get much real investment growth in the US after 2008 for a number of years. And that's why now raising interest rates are going to have just the opposite effect. It will cool down the economy faster than they think. I find it interesting that what does a Fed Chair Powell say when he indicated on Wednesday that they were raising interest rates, right? Well, what he said was, we're raising interest rates because inflation is so low. Inflation in the US is about 1.5%, right? Core inflation. And he says, oh, it's low, therefore we can raise interest rates. Well, that's the inverse of what Bernanke and Yellen, the former chairs from 2008 to 16, were saying. They were saying, we got to lower interest rates because we have no inflation. We can lower interest rates because we have no inflation. Well, now, we got Powell saying we can raise interest rates because we have no inflation. Well, who the hell's right? Neither. Neither are right. All this talk about raising inflation to 2% is just a big cover. A big cover. It's not what their real objective is. The real objective under Bernanke and Yellen was to reduce interest rates to zero in order to subsidize the banks and their banking buddies. Yes. And of course, the zero interest rates were a nice incentive for non-bank companies to issue debt, which they then use to buy their stock or pay out dividends or invest offshore, you see. So it caused the debt to increase on the corporate side, the zero interest rates for 7 years, 7, 8 years almost, right? Zero interest rates. That was the whole economic strategy of during Obama years. Lower interest rates, the Fed, and that would subsidize the banks and subsidize corporate debt. Had nothing to do with 2% inflation. That's how they sell it, you see. And now we've got the same thing going with our buddy here, Jerome Powell, who is raising rates because, oh, there's no inflation. We don't have to worry. Let's raise rates. But why is he really raising rates? Just as Bernanke and Yellen lowered rates to subsidize the banks for years on end after they were bailed out, even. What we've got is raising rates, not because of the inflation target, but we're raising rates to pay for the trillion-dollar budget deficits coming every year for the next 10 years. The Fed knows. The Fed knows that it has to borrow more money in order to finance these huge trillion-dollar deficits. So it's raising rates to entice investors to buy more treasury bonds. Look at what's happening first 3 years. They're issuing all kind of new treasury bonds, right? They know they desperately have to raise rates. But the contradiction is raising rates to cover the budget deficit is going to slow down the economy and cause even more of a budget deficit. Okay, so that's the relationship between these three strategic important developments in the last week. The Fed raising rates, what's really behind it. Trump's deja vu trade war. Nixon, Reagan, Trump. It's all the same thing. I'll be writing about that. Check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, in the next couple of days for the piece I'm writing on that. And also check out the series, once again, on my systemic fragility. And I will probably post once again on my website, which you can get through through my blog, my forthcoming publication in the World Financial Review, which is simply entitled Yellen's Legacies, Powell's Dilemmas. Again, an analysis of where we're at with Fed and monetary policy. So, you know, if you want to follow up on some of these themes, check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, and my website, kiklosproductions.com, that you can get to by clicking on the toolbar on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Also, you may want to follow my Twitter handle here, at drjackrasmus, where I plug in very short observations on what's going on here in the economy and so forth. So those three sources, if you really want to follow up in more detail here. But trade war with China? No, trade skirmish, and we're going to renegotiate, tweak it, just as we're doing with the Europeans, just as we did with the South Koreans, just as we're doing with Mexico and Canada. This is all about getting a better deal for U.S. corporations, you see, globally. And it won't result in more jobs. Forget it. That's just the politicians' lies to get people to buy into politicians' elections and politicians' policies. And, of course, the budget deficit here. The phony budget maneuvers going on. Who is going to pay for these deficits? You know, it's going to be grandma. It's going to be students. It's going to be single moms working at or near minimum wage, relying on Medicare and food stamps, you know, in this country. Okay. And then, of course, we have the backstory here of the Democrats maneuvering on DACA, right? They don't want to resolve DACA. They want to keep it dangling out there. And Trump doesn't want to resolve DACA either until he gets his full funding, $30 billion for the wall. So those negotiations are going to continue. And all you poor DACA folks, don't get too anxious because nothing's going to be resolved for at least another year, if then. Okay, I think that finishes it for today and what we got to say on those three important topics. So we're going to finish up a little early here and listen to some good music. You know, the network will put something on, I'm sure. Rather than me just continue saying the same thing, we're going to end it on those three themes. Okay, next week, I'm sure we're going to have some very interesting developments. The sideshow, economic sideshow, never stops. This is Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Business. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now.